So we're holding on page 50 in Sanhedrin, Os Nun Dalam. The Mishnah had said, Pisco quotation from the Mishnah, Hebu Yodin Chola, we tell the Beis Din warns the Edim to be aware of the consequences if they're testifying falsely and are going to get an innocent person killed, and we tell them that you should realize, for example, look what happened with Cain, where the pasuk says, Kol Dmei Achicha, Tzayakimelai, and why Dmei in the plural is because not only him, it's all the future potential descendants that he can have, that he could have had. Hashem is saying, Cain, you're responsible for all of their deaths. And then the Mishnah brings another explanation, show you Dami Mutal, Allah Aitz and Balavan, and that his blood was spattered all over the stones and the wood, which can mean, in other words, the stones and wood of wherever they were located. Mausha says it can also mean, the Medrash says, as we're going to say now in the Gemara, that he didn't know how to kill Hevel. He didn't know the Chalav, there's such a thing as killing a person. This is, the world is new, after all. So that's the point. It doesn't just mean all over the place. It also means, Mausha says, he hit him with a club, and he hit him with a rock, and therefore those now have blood of Hevels on them. The particular ones that he used as weapons, in other words. But yeah, the other meaning would be all the wooden stone, all the trees and stones and whatnot that were within a couple of feet of it. Why does it mean Dmei Achicha? Now again, as we learned yesterday, the Yad Ramah points out that Sanhedrin doesn't necessarily tell that line to the agent. We don't want to undercut when we're telling them, realize that Dmei Achicha means the blood of all his millions and billions of future descendants. You don't want to also undercut that by saying, by the way, it can also mean the blood was splattered all over the place. On the other hand, as we said yesterday, the Rif says, maybe it is actually that it means every single one of those places is crying out that his blood be avenged, and the same thing will be true if you're causing this guy to be killed for no reason. Anyway, so Omer of Yehuda Bereid Rav Chiya, Melamed Sha'osa Kain VeHevel Achiv Chaburis Chaburis Ptzias Ptzias. He was making in Hevel many different wounds and many different injuries. He didn't know from where the neshama leaves. The world was new. No human being had ever been killed yet. He had no idea what kind of blow is a killing blow. Until he reached Hevel's neck, and then he killed him with her, and then he killed him with a blow or a cut or whatever over there. So therefore, that's the meaning of killed Dmei Achicha. That's why there's many different bloods. Eitz Yosef points out, based on the Medrash, we have generations based on Yifei Toyar, on the Medrash, we know generations later when Lemech accidentally killed Cain and his wives want to stay away from him and so forth, and he tells them, Ki ish haragti lefitzi, v'yelad b'chaburosi, so meaning, in other words, he's saying, look, I'm not like Cain, who killed Hevel, who was still a yelad chronologically, because it was only shortly after he had been born, even though he's already a mature adult. So I didn't do such a thing. Lefitzi l'chaburosi implies that Cain killed Hevel by means of as we're saying over here. So therefore, that shows that he wounded him and injured him in many different ways before he actually killed him. Ever since the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the blood and accepted and swallowed up the blood of Hevel, shuv like Pascha, it never opened its mouth again. Shenamar, as the pasuk says. Now, Tosfos points out that in general, when a person is killed and the blood seeps into the ground, then you don't see it anymore. So what's the chiddush of what happened over here? Tosfos explains, yes, that's true, but generally there'll be some kind of residue of it left on the surface. You can tell on the bare ground that blood was spilled over here. Here, the earth completely covered and swallowed it up. An interesting explanation of why it would have done that, an interesting explanation is that Marsha points out is, we know that Cain and Hevel attempted to split up the whole world between them. They took the view, Cain's the farmer, Hevel's the shepherd, so Cain has the run of the entire land, and Hevel has all of the Baal HaShayim, all the animals and whatnot. So therefore, so now the earth belonged to Cain in that sense, based on that. So therefore, it was trying to like help him cover up the crime by swallowing up the blood completely. But therefore, Hashem, as Hashem says to Cain, now the earth is cursed because of you, Asher Potsa Eretz Pia, that it opened up its mouth and swallowed up the blood so completely. So it never again opened its mouth. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Miknaf ha'aretz, from the edge of the earth, Zmiris shamainu, we have heard songs, Tzvi la'tzadik, a beautiful thing for the tzadik. So what's Miknaf ha'aretz? Why are we hearing these sounds only from the edge of the earth and not from the mouth of the earth? So the reason is Miknafa Aretz was not sure. It was Miknafa Aretz, Valemi Piha Aretz. We only hear it from the edge of the earth, not from the mouth of it, because it's never able to open its mouth to sing to Hashem again. So now the earth can never again open its mouth for good. So meaning, in other words, that Marsha says, now all creatures say Shira to Hashem. You have the famous Perek Shira that lists all the different Shiras that all the different creations in the world sing to Hashem. The earth is unable to do it with its mouth. It can only do it with its edge. So what does that signify? Some of us can talk about a couple of possibilities and include the point, for example, without that, it should have been that we should be able to perceive Hashem in the natural workings of the world. That would be the earth opening up its mouth and singing. Al derech, in other words, all the other creatures, they sing with their mouths open. We can look at the creatures and realize the greatness of Hashem in making them. The earth and then the natural world in general, it becomes hard to do that. It looks to our perception as though the world runs itself. So we only see it from the edge. Like it's hard to see it in a clear way. So that's the point. Rav Shmuel Fall Hirsch makes a point in one place in his commentary on Tehillim when it talks about Yismach Hashemayim V'Sogel Aretz. He says basically there'll come a time when V'Sogel Aretz, when the earth is going to be able to rejoice. Why? When the people on it are acting the way they're supposed to. Right now the earth can't sing because it's sad by the fact that this started with Cain's crime and it continues from there. It has to support a whole bunch of people on it who are not acting the way they're supposed to, and therefore it's like it's sad and it can't open its mouth to sing to Hashem. So the Gemara continues. Tosfos also brings in this connection that it refers to the wings of the Malachim. And in particular, Tosfos talks about that it brings from Tshuvas HaGaonim that on Shabbos, in particular, Hashem hears this song from the edges. Miknafa Oretz literally means from the wings of the earth. So that song is specially sung on Shabbos. So the Gemara says, Eisei Chizkia Achim. So Rabbi Yehuda's brother Chizkia questioned him on the basis of a pasuk. The Gemara is going to mention soon that Yehuda and Chizkia were the sons of Rabchia. They were actually twins. The Gemara tells us in Yevamos that Rabchia and his wife, her name was Yehudis, had two twin boys, and then they had two twin girls. So Yehuda and Chizkia were two twins. We often find them mentioned in the Gemara together as Bnei Rabchia. It seems that Yehuda eventually passed away young. Chizkia lived much longer. In particular, we find in many places he was one of Rabbi Yochanan's Rebbes, and we actually often find Machlokas in Shas between Chizkia and his Talmud Rabbi Yochanan. Anyway, so Eisei Chizkia Achiv. So Chizkia, the brother of Rabbi Yehuda, questioned him on the basis of, you're telling me the earth never again opened its mouth, but the pasuk says, by Korach, Vatiftach Haaretz Hespia, that the earth opened up its mouth and swallowed them. Amalei, so Yehuda answers him, L'ra'a pascha l'toivah l'pascha. From then on, the earth can only open its mouth for bad, like, for example, to punish the Rishoyim, to swallow Korach and company, l'toivah l'pascha, but it doesn't open its mouth for good. Tosfos points out there is another example. We find after Kriyas Yamsuf where the earth opened up and swallowed their bodies. Rashi mentions on the pasuk that it was in the schar, they deserved some kind of burial in the schar that Pare after all had admitted after one of the makas Hashem HaTzadik, so therefore they deserve burial for that. I think there's also a medrash that says it's a result of because the Mitzrayim honored Yaakov at his burial. Whatever the case, we see that the earth swallowed up their corpses. So Tosfos' answer is that's not the good of the Mitzrayim. We're not calling that good. When we talk about good, we mean good for the Jewish people, good for, but we're not talking about the good of the Mitzrayim. The fact that they got burial, that's not considered opening its mouth for good. An interesting implication of that, though, is it almost seems as though we're saying that to begin with, opening up its mouth to swallow Hevel's blood was good, and we're saying from then on it doesn't get to open its mouth for good anymore. How was it good? So the Taz gives an interesting answer. He says that we're saying on the one hand it was covering up Cain's crime. On the other hand, though, you know, there is a good thing to it, and that Hevel gets a decent burial, all his blood gets a decent burial, and you don't have that there's a residue of it on the ground. So therefore, in that sense, there was a certain good to it. Nevertheless, it's being blamed that it did that, and therefore, from then on, it doesn't get to open the Torah anymore.
So it says, hey,
Hevel
Achicha,
he's hidden. He's hidden, yeah. That's interesting. That he's completely hidden. Interesting. Okay. Here's another thing we can learn from the story of Cain. Golus mechaperes ova in Mechze. Golus is mechaper half of a person's averis. Half of the punishment that a person should have gotten for his averis. Because meikru ksiva, you see novanod, at first, when Cain is being told off by Hashem, how could you do this? And he says, Hashem, this is too harsh a punishment for me. God will have any minister. He says, well, you see, nov and nod, I'm going to be a wanderer and a fugitive. So you have two expressions, na and nod. All of a sudden, later on it says he settled in the land of Noid. So he still had to have the Noid, which is the same shorish as nod, but he didn't have the na having to move about all the time. So his golos was vayetze kayin, that he had to leave. That golos was mechafer half for him. Marshall says, wait a second, though. Doesn't the word novanod itself mean golos? So what, his golos was mechaper for half, it's for half his golos? How does that work? So no, Marshall says, it must be that the words novanod mean, it must mean that it doesn't mean golos, as in fact, what it means is that wherever he's going, the earth is trembling underneath him. So now the fact that golos, he says to Hashem, hein gerashta oisi, you've kicked me out of your possession, and vayetze kayin, so that took away half the novanod, now it's not trembling underneath him anymore. Now he's vayesha be'eretz noid, he does have to settle on the land of wanderers, but he's not everywhere he's going, the earth is not quaking underneath him anymore. On the other hand, Marsha brings from the Medrash that says that actually it's not so much the Golos that's Mechaper Mechza, it's the Tshuva that's Mechaper Mechza. He did Tshuva. He said, Godol Avonim in Esoi, which my sin is too great to bear. Now, there's a few different ways of understanding that phrase. It can mean the punishment is too great to bear, and in that case, it's like complaining to Hashem, you punish me too harshly. But another meaning of it is my sin is too great to bear. I realize that, you know, I did a terrible, unforgivable thing, and that's one stage of Tshuva. There is also, Rashi mentions on the pasuk, it's also meant kind of as a rhetorical question against Hashem, what, you can't bear my sin, but eventually you're going to bear and then be willing to forgive the sin of the Jewish people with the Chet HaEgel. So there's a lot of different angles in what he's saying over here. Some of them sincere tshuva, and some of them still rebelliousness against Hashem, but whatever the case, the Medrash takes it. As in Chet HaEgel, he knew, because in particular... Well, he's a Rosha, but he's still, Hashem spoke to him, so he's obviously on some Madrega, but also, you know, it says that Hashem showed Adam dur Chachamav and all that, so Hashem showed it to Adam, so Adam probably gave over at least certain important parts of it to Cain. But anyway, again, you have to realize, you know, as much as Cain was obviously a vile Rosha, and, you know, he was the greatest mass murderer in history. You think about it, he killed one quarter of the entire Earth's population. But nevertheless, you know, the fact is, again, you know, we do see the Eibishter spoke to him and his words are recorded in the Torah, so he's not Sam a lowlife, you know. In fact, actually, you look at it, by the way, you can actually see a certain Mila in him over Hevel as well. Who was the one who came up first with the idea of bringing the carbon? Cain. Hevel improved on it by bringing the best, but Cain was the first one to come up with the idea. That's a big thing in itself. Getting back to, so Marsha brings from the Medrash that actually it's not so much Golos Mechaper Mechze, but Tshuva Mechaper Mechze. So then it could mean, following that Medrash, Novanod may well mean that he had to wander around all the time, and now that's Mechaper, that at least he's able to stay in one country. Why does Golos Mechaper Mechze? The Maharal gives an explanation, because a person's Mokim is part of his identity. You find in a get, for example, you have to write the name of the city where the husband and wife live. We find with many Gerli Yisrael that they're identified by their city. The Maharal himself is often called the Maharal of Prague, for example. We have many examples of that. So therefore, like a person's city is place where he lives, is part of his identity, and when that's taken away from him, and he pravis golos, then that takes away a certain part of his identity, and therefore it takes away a certain amount of his punishment. And the Gemara continues in this vein, talking about what Golos accomplishes for a person. Amar Rav Yehuda, Golos mechaperes gimel dvarim. Golos is mechaper three punishments that a person might otherwise have had to undergo. Shenemar, as the pasuk says in Yirmiyah, talking right during the siege, right before Churban Bayis Rishon. So the Navi says to the people, Koyam Hashem, Hayosha Be'ir Hazois, anybody who stays behind in this city of Yerushalayim, Yomus Bachera Barov Vadover, is going to die of the sword or of hunger or of plague. Vayotze V'nofal Alakastim, but anyone who goes out and surrenders to the Kastim, V'choya, or the actual Lashon of the pasuk, Ksarim Aleichem, who are besieging you, V'choya, then he will live, V'hoysalei Nafshe L'Shalol, and his life will be like spoils for him. In other words, like if you think of in a war, you want to be able to collect a lot of spoils, his reward will be that he saves his life. So in other words, the point is, the Gemara is saying that the Navi is telling them that your golos, the fact that you're going to have to leave your houses in Yerushalayim and may never come back to them, that will be mechaper that you don't have to undergo the other three punishments that the Pasuk is saying. So in fact, the Maharal points out, based on there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that talks about that why Pidyon Shavuyim is considered the greatest possible tzedakah and pretty much the greatest possible mitzvah is because a person who was captured by Goyim is in danger, like this. You have, for example, a person could die of hunger, a person could die of disease or whatever, whereas when he's in Golos, when he's in captivity, any of those things could happen. His captors could do any of the above to him. So they could starve him, they could kill him by the sword, etc. So therefore, in that sense, now this golos has an element of all those three things, and then therefore it's mechaper and forestalls that he doesn't have to undergo any of those things, and that he doesn't actually have to undergo any of those things. So v'choya, he'll get to live, that's it. He's not getting anything else out of it, but at least we see that it saves him from those three things. Rabbi Yochanan, I'm a golos mechaperis ala kol. Now, Rabbi Yochanan says actually golos is mechaper for everything, not just that he. So in other words, Marsha says like this. The first opinion, Rabbi Yehuda b'Reidi Rabbi Chiya, is that golos is mechaper for half of what a person should undergo as punishment. Rabbi Yehuda, the Amora, is saying that it's mechaper for everything, but he won't return to his original greatness. As those Jews who followed Yirmiyah's advice and surrendered to the Kasdim, they went to Babel, they never returned to Yerushalayim, at least not to the greatness of Yerushalayim as it was in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash. If any of them survived to the second Beis HaMikdash, then at least, you know, Yerushalayim is in a much poorer situation then. Now Rabbi Yochanan is saying, it's mechaper ala kol, even that the people will be able to regain their original status. Shenema, as you find a pasuk regarding Yechonia. Now Yechonia was the now Yechonia or Yehoyachin, he goes by a few different names. So he was the next to last king of Yehuda, and the pasuk says he was a Rosh. So he was taken prisoner by Nebuchadnezzar, and he was brought to Babel. So Yirmiyah says a very harsh nevuah about him. Koyam Hashem, kisvo se'isha ze'ariri, write down that this man, Yechonia, is going to be childless. Gever la Yitzchak b'yomav, a man who's never going to have any success during his lifetime. He's never going to have any atzlocha. Ki la Yitzchak mizare ish yoshev akisid David, that he will never have the success of seeing that there will be any man from his descendants who will sit on the throne of David, or Moshe Oibi Yehuda, or who will ever rule over Yehuda. So in other words, he's a goner. He's going to be childless, and he's not going to have a dynasty of kings coming from him. Obasa de Gola, meanwhile, after he went into Golos, when he was in Babel, Ksiv, later on, we find he did have descendants. And not only he had descendants, but as we're going to say, they were in fact the leaders of the Jewish people at the beginning of the day, at the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. So he did have Moshe Oibi Yehuda. So the pasuk says, "Uvnei Yechonia Asir Shaltiel Benoi." The pasuk says, "The sons of Yechonia Asir, his son Shal." The word Benoi over here is in parenthesis; it's not actually in the pasuk. Shaltiel Benoi. There's different ways among Mefoshim understanding the pasuk pshat of it. Does it mean that he had a son Asir who had a son Shaltiel, or does it mean that Asir is a nickname for Yechonia itself? Asir means a prisoner because he was in prison in Babel. In any case, so now the Gemara is downshining. What do these names, Asir and Shaltiel, mean? Asir, who was so called, she brate imu bebeis ha'asurim. His mother became pregnant with him in the jail. So Shaltiel, she shosle keel shaloi kederach anishtolin. What?
Shaltiel,
Hashem implanted him in his mother's womb, not in the normal way that babies are implanted. Gemiri, because we know from our Rabbeim, Eina Ishim is Saberes Ma'uman. A woman doesn't become pregnant standing up, maybe once in a great while, but it's very uncommon that she'll get pregnant standing up, because whatever, the Zera will dribble out. V'hinis Abra Ma'ubad, she did. She was able to become pregnant standing up. What happened? Rashi refers to a Medrash in Vayikra Rabbah that tells the details. The Medrash says like this. First, it tells the whole story of how Yechoniah ended up getting captured by Nebuchadnezzar. It's a long story. The gist of it is his father, Jehoiakim, had rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and then eventually Nebuchadnezzar had moved his army into Eretz Yisrael and ordered them to hand over Jehoiakim. And the Medrash brings a machlokas whether in the end they killed Jehoiakim, or whether Nebuchadnezzar killed him, or whether he died on the way to going to surrender. Whatever the case, he appointed Jehoiakim's son Yechoniah as the next king. Goes back home. Nebuchadnezzar's ministers tell him, was that really a good idea, Your Majesty? I mean, they say, you don't get a good puppy from a bad dog. If his father was rebelling against you, the son's not likely to be any better. So Nebuchadnezzar comes back with his army. The whole time Yechoniah was king, the pasuk says 3 months and 10 days. So he brings his army right back, and again he demands Yechoniah's surrender. Yechoniah at least was better than his father, so he went and surrendered voluntarily, rather than forcing the Sanhedrin to hand him over. In any case, so he was taken to jail in Babel. Now, continues the Medrash, the Chachamim got concerned. There was one more king after him, Tzidkiah. Tzidkiah was also taken prisoner by Nebuchadnezzar at the time of the Churban and brought to Babel. His children were killed. So now the Chachamim were concerned. The whole Malchus Beis David may go extinct. Who's there going to be? Anybody left that we can have descendants of Malchus Beis David? So to make a long story short, they managed to get access to the queen and have her talk to her husband, Nebuchadnezzar, to allow Yechoniah conjugal visit in jail. You were just saying, in jail nowadays, they allow such things. So fine, allow him to have his wife visit him in jail. Now, it was a very narrow jail. There wasn't even room to lay down, for the two of them to lay down. So they'd have to have relations standing up. But then the Medrash continues, an amazing thing. Now here, the Gemara is focusing on the goddess of Yechoniah that was machapa for him. Again, that Medrash focuses more on his tshuva. When she was lowered down into that jail, that she realizes all of a sudden she became nida. And she tells her husband, Yechoniah. Now, we just learned in the Gemara the other day that even the Rekon and Shabbat, even the empty Jews, Malay Mitzvah Terimen, and Sugar Basheshanim, and all that, and are careful about that. So Yechoniah, at that moment, held himself back and did Tshuva, and said, in that case, then we can't. If that means I have to die childless, and this was my only opportunity, so be it. We can't be over on that. So the Medrash continues. So afterwards, they had to wait till she was Tahar again, and then they managed to get the queen to convince Nebuchadnezzar to give her another chance, and that's when their son Shaltiel was conceived. So we see that it was Shaloi Kederach HaNishtol, didn't even have room to lay down, and nevertheless, they made it happen. Dover Acher, another explanation of the name Shaltiel. So in the simple sense, Asir is the actual son of Yechoniah. But now the Gemara is mentioning Asir that he was so called because he was conceived in jail, and Shaltiel because he was conceived in this unusual way. Dover Acher, Shaltiel, another reason for the name Shaltiel, Shenishal al Olose Kale. It stands for the words Shenishal al Olose Kale, that Hashem, so to speak, asked to be moichel, to be matir on his neder. He had made this gzera, this shvur, that Yechoniah would never have children and would never have descendants. So now, he had to have hataras nedarim done. So Rashi says it was done by the Pamalia Shomaila. The pasuk actually says a shvur over there that in that connection, that Hashem literally swore that this would be the case. So now Hashem, so to speak, has to be matir neder. What does it mean for Hashem to be, in token of that, they called him Shaltiel. Now, what does it mean for Hashem to be matir neder, of course? I mean, to be matir neder implies that you change your mind, and Hashem doesn't change his mind. First of all, by the way, when Rashi says that he was Pamali Shamaila, the Yad Ramah says, no, come on, there's no such thing. He says what it means, not there's no such thing, but you can't say that the Pamali Shamaila would be matir to him. The Yad Ramah says what it means is basically that Hashem is going to act like this. A shvua means that there's a strong zera against him, and Hashem is going to undo that zera and allow him to have children. The Maharam Shif in a different place, we learned in Baba Basra, for example, we have the story of Rava Baba Chana, where he's by Har Sinai, and Hashem is said as a Bastel saying, Oyvei that I swore, and now who's going to be matter to me? So we talked about over there, and the Binyan Shloima brings over here from Maharam Shif, that it means also, we don't even have to be talking about Hataras Nedarim, which requires Charota, and you can't say, how can you speak of Charota by Hashem? How can you talk about Hashem regretting something which would imply that he doesn't know the future, Chas V'Shalom, but rather, the Maharam Shif says we can be talking about it more in terms of hafara, hafaras nedarim as a husband does for his wife. Well, there are certain high-level tzaddikim. For example, it says about Moshe Rabbeinu, when it calls him Ish HaElokim, the Zohar says that means, in the sense, he's like the husband, and the Shekhinah, so to speak, is the wife. So therefore, so Moshe is able to be Matir Neder, so to speak, for Hashem. So in the same vein over here, it would be, in other words, that Hashem is able to, that tzaddikim are able to be Mefer, the Neder, for Hashem, and make it then, and then, and take that away.
It says the Tovo Velo Velo Tovo, that Hashem is Mefer for when this,
No, what it says is when Hashem promises he's going to do something, doesn't have to be a shvua. When Hashem tells a Navi he's going to do something good, then Hashem doesn't take it back. So that, but there we're not talking about a shvua. Here we're talking about a shvua. There was an actual shvua that's mentioned in the pasuk over there in Yirmiyah. So like this, we talk about again that there had to be a toras nedarim or a foras nedarim, so to speak, in order for Hashem to do it. Another interesting point about it is b'chlal. What does it mean in general when we talk about Hashem acting with a certain emotion towards us? So of course, you know, divra Torah kolashim ne'adam. But one point of it means that a person is acting in a way that evokes a certain way of Hashem acting towards him. One famous marshal that's given for that, you know, the same way you put a bunch of different substances in the sun, and some of them are going to melt, and some of them are going to solidify, whatever, you know, depending on their chemical, on their physical properties. So it's the same sun, but it affects each thing differently. The same way, the Eibishter is Echad Miyuchad, but how he relates to each of us is depending on how we ourselves act. So then the vote would be, in other words, that Hashem, so to speak, made a shvua that Yechoniah, as he is now, as a Rasha, is going to be Gever Lo Yitzchak, etc. But now that he turned himself into a new person, then it's almost like we don't even need to be Matir the shvua. The shvua no longer applies because it never applied to that, person in the first place. The Rambam brings this in Hilchos Teshuvah. The Rambam is following the so again, all Gemara is focusing more on the Golos. The Medrash that Rashi refers to is focusing more on the Teshuvah that Yechoniah did over there, and the Rambam follows suit in Hilchos Teshuvah. He brings us an example that actually he says even more so in that Nevuah. In that Nevuah against Yechoniah, Hashem says, Chai Oni, Hashem says, as I live, a Lashon Shvuah, even if Yechoniah were to be a signet ring on my right hand, and if you think of it, a person's signet ring is like his most prized personal possession. The Gemara even says nobody lends out his signet ring to somebody else. They don't want anyone to forge documents with it or whatever in his name. So even if Yechoniah were like a signet ring on my right hand, Misham et Kenka, I would tear you off of there. In other words, I want nothing to do with you. Now you find that Amram says the very same Lashon that Eibishter uses about Zerubbabel, who was, we're going to say now in the Gemara, was Yechoniah's grandson, who became the leader of the Jewish people at the beginning of the second Beis Mikdash. The Navi says on him, by Yemahu, Hashem says, on that day, I'm going to take you, Zerubbabel, v'samtikachachachoyson. I'm going to put you as a signet on my hand, Hashem says, Kabyachol. So the exact same Lashon that Hashem used to reject his grandfather when he was a Rosha, now that his grandfather did Tshuva, Hashem uses that very same Lashon to talk about how close he wants Zerubbabel to be to him. So this is an example that Amram says. I have a person when he did Averis, the Eibishter finds him disgusting and repulsive, v'chola, as all the Lashonis he says, but then he does Tshuva, and all of a sudden he's Ahuv and beloved and precious and Chaviv and so forth to the Eibishter. So the Gemara continues, Zerubbabel. Now here's another name that we have in that family, Zerubbabel. Why was he called that? Shenizra b'Babel. He was seeded, he was planted in Babel. In the sense, in other words, Maharshal says that the connection is that there wouldn't have been a Zerubbabel had there not been a Shaltiel. And there wouldn't have been a Shaltiel had Yechoniah not gone in Golos into Babel. Because if without that Golos, again, he would have been that miserable Rosha, never having had any children. So therefore, in effect, the fact that there's a Zerubbabel, Shaltiel names it, Maharshal explains, Shaltiel names his son Zerubbabel in gratitude for the fact, how does our family continue to have a Kiyum and to exist, is in the course of the fact that my father, Yechoniah, was taken into Golos in Babel. So therefore, he called him Zerubbabel. Umashmoy, what's his real name? Nechemiah ben Chachalia Shmoy. His real name is Nechemiah ben Chachalia. So therefore, in other words, the vote would be that's his real name, and all these other names that we're saying, Shaltiel and Zerubbabel and so forth, are nicknames based on the events that we're saying over here. A couple of Mephoshim point out the Yad Ramah, I think, points it out, and then Rabbi Yaakov Emden. There are actually psukim that mention Zerubbabel and Nechemiah separately, mashma that they are actually two people. So how can the Gemara say that's the same person? Okay, Akasha. Fine. The Gemara goes on, speaking of Yehuda and Chizkiah, the sons of Rabchia. The Gemara says, Yehuda and Chizkiah, Bnei Rabchia, Havu Yasvi Bisudasa. These two Chachamim were one time sitting at a Suda, Kamei de Rebbe, in front of Rebbe, Velei Havu Ka'ami, Velei Midi, and they weren't saying anything. Young Tamil Chachamim, and they're not saying a vort of Torah by the table. Omelahu, Amri Lahu. So Rebbe said to the waiters or whatever over there, Agvaru Chamra Adardiki, increase the amount of wine that we're giving to the young men, Kihechi Delengu Mil, so that way it'll open up their mouths and they'll say something. No, well, not while they're drinking, but it would be the effect of the wine. You know, wine loosens people's tongues, so this way they'll say something. And this way, after they drink, then they'll be more in a frame of mind to say something. Not when they're eating, but between courses, between whatever, yeah. Given the ifsum, when they had drunk, they started saying, Ein ben David ba, atshiyichlu shtei bote ovis miyisrael. Ben David, Mashiach, will not come until two great families disappear from the Jewish people. Elohein, Rosh Golos of Bavel, the Nasi Shabbat Yisrael, the Rosh Golosa, the governor of the Jews in Bavel, and the Nasi in Eretz Yisrael, both of whom are descended from David HaMelech. The Gemara, there's a Yerushalmi that says that the Rosh Golosa were descended from David Ben Achaben. There's a Yerushalmi that says the Nasiim, starting from Hillel and on, were descended from David only on the mother's side. But in any case, these two Chachamim are saying only when those two families disappear, only then will Mashiach come. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Vahoya the Mikdash, Hashem, or actually Vahoya, he will be, Rashi says, means refers to Mashiach and Shai Yisrael, Mashiach, will be the Mikdash, he will be the Jewish people's holy thing, Ula Evan Negev, he will be as a stumbling stone, meaning in other words, he's gonna take us out of the golus which currently causes our feet to stumble and get injured, ulatsum michshel, and a rock over which they trip, the shnei bote Yisrael, because of the two families of the Jewish people. Meaning, as long as those two families, Pashup Shat is the shnei bote Yisrael refers to the kingdom of Yehuda and Yisrael that existed in Yishai and Yishai's times. But since we know that every nevuah is written only if it's needed for all time, so now Yehuda and Chizkiah also explaining, it means the Shnei Bati Yisrael, these two great families of the Jewish people who rule over the Jewish people in Bavel and Eretz Yisrael respectively, they have to disappear, and only then will the stumbling blocks and so forth of Golos disappear, and V'hoyo V'mikdash and Mashiach will be our Holy One. Omalahem. So Rebbe says to them, Bonai, my sons, my Talmidim, Kotzimata Matumli Be'inai, you're putting thorns in my eyes. You realize I'm the Nasi. You're telling me that me and my whole family has to disappear in order for Mashiach to come. Amalei Reb Chia, so Reb Chia answers him, Rebbe al Yera Be'inecha. Rebbe, it shouldn't be bad in your eyes. What they're saying is actually true. Yayin Nitin B'Shivim Osius, the Soid Nitin B'Shivim Osius. The words Yayin and Soid both have a gematria of 70. Nichnas Yayin, Yotza Soid, when wine comes in, secrets come out. So they drank the wine. What they said is actually a secret of Torah, a true secret of Torah. So you shouldn't feel bad about it. Now, what kind of an answer is that? The fact is, shouldn't he feel bad that it still means that his family has to disappear? So Marsha brings a long explanation over here relating this to a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, also involving Reb Chiya and Rebbe. The Gemara tells over there, and like this, we know that a Chodesh Halavana is 29 and a half days, and the normal time to see the moon should be on the night after the 29th. So the Edom should be looking for it right around sunset on the night of the 29th, and then if they see it, then they'll come the next day to Beis Din, and Beis Din will declare Rosh Chodesh. So one time, the Gemara tells us that the morning of the 29th, Reb Chiya still saw the moon in the sky. Now that's a problem. It takes time from when the moon disappears at the end of the month before it's visible again. So if it's still visible the morning of the 29th, it can't possibly again be visible that evening of the 29th. Therefore, it's going to create problems with the date that they wanted Rosh Hashanah to come out on. So Reb Chiya tells the moon, you have to go cover yourself, go disappear. And it did, and then the Gemara continues. Rebbe says to Reb Chiya, go to Ein Tav, which was a place where they would go to do Kiddush HaChodesh, and there you'll be Mekadosh HaChodesh. Rashi explains, one point over there is, like this, you do it locally here, people are going to wonder, hey, a lot of us saw the moon on the morning of the 29th, what do you mean you're doing it, you're doing your Chodesh already based on a sighting of the moon tonight? It can't possibly be a real sighting, and they're going to be Meranin, they're going to call it into question. Therefore he tells him, go to Ein Tav, which is a different area, they won't won't have seen the moon there, and there won't be a problem. Anyway, and then he says, send me a message that you've done it. With the, you'll send me the message, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, which is the phrase that we said by Kiddush Levana. What's the idea? So we know the famous thing that Malchus Beis David is compared to the moon. The, you came to 15 generations after Adam Rish, after Avraham Avinu comes Shlomo HaMelech Chai Masir Bashlamosa, and from then on it starts waning until the Malchus disappears. So the Jewish people are compared to the moon, and the Malchus Beis David in particular was compared to the moon. So therefore, so that explains, Marshall says, so that's why when the moon needed to be told to become invisible, it had to be Reb Chiya who says it, not Rebbe himself. And then, because Rebbe doesn't want that the Nesios should disappear, so he tells Reb Chiya that you have to go tell it to be invisible, and you also send me the message, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayim. It's true, the moon disappearing is a bad simon for the Nesios, but it's a good simon, because after the moon disappears, it comes up again, and there'll be, and then, Semach David Abraham Heir Satzmiach. Therefore, go to Ein Tav, meaning a Simen Toiv. So now then, Rabbi Chiya's sons are speaking in the same vein. They're saying when the two Bote Ovis disappear, like the moon disappears at the end of the month, then the Malchus will be renewed, like, in other words, Mashiach will come. But still, Rabbi felt bad about it, because it means that his family and his Nesios has to disappear. So Rabbi Chiya tells us, you know what, this is Yotzeh Soid, and not just any Soid, Soid HaIbur. The secret, we usually use Soda Ibra to mean the secret, the intricate calculations that the Basin needs to know in order to calculate when the moon is visible and when not, and so forth. But here, we're using Soda Ibra in the sense that the deeper secret, why the Eivishta made the moon this way, that it has to wax and wane and disappear and reappear, and why it is that way with Malchus Beis David and with Mashiach as well. So the upshot of it is that these two families have to disappear, and once they've disappeared, as of course nowadays they have, then we're ready for the moon to come out of hiding again and for Mashiach to come.
What is that?
The place was called Ein Tav. Ein Tav, so Marsha points out. This is Al Shem, Simen Toiv. Ein Tova, but then, yeah, then specifically Tav, Meloshen Tova is in a Simen Tov for the Jewish people. So go to Ein Tav and be Mekadosh L'Chodesh, representing that there is a continuation to the moon, there is a continuation to the Jewish people, and send me the Simen as a password, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayim, representing that the moon will be renewed and that the Jewish people and Malchus Beis David will be renewed. In fact, it's brought in Sfarim, that the phrase David Melech Yisrael Chai, first of all, we have actually in the Pasuk in Kapitel Pei Tes, you have the whole Kapitel Pei, much of Kapitel Pei Tes is about Malchus Beis David, and the composer of the Kapitel is complaining, Hayitachin, you made such promises to David, and now look what happened to Malchus Beis David. But anyway, you actually have a lotion over there, Ki Yareach Yikun Olam, that David's Malchus will be forever like the moon. So you really, really have that comparison in an actual pasuk. But it's brought also in Sfarim, the words Rosh Chodesh are the same gematria as David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim. So there is that connection. So now, again, Yehuda and Chizkiah are pointing that out also, that once those two families, once that moon, so to speak, disappears, then we're ready for the moon to be renewed and to be visible again, namely for Mashiach to come. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gu'ola, of Tes Zayin Sivan. So continuing on the topic, we started yesterday from the Sikha of Shoftim Nun Aleph, where the Rebbe was talking about Nevuah nowadays. We talked about yesterday that the Rambam had said there was going to come a point when Tachzu Nevuah Yisrael. Now, the Rambam tells us in great length in Sefer HaMadir, in Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah, that one of the fundamentals of Yiddishkeit is to know that Hashem gives Nevuah to people, and that we have, and then the Rambam goes and talks in detail about the mitzvah to listen to a Navi. So therefore, the Rebbe talks about in that sikha, we have to know this halacha nowadays, even before the Gola, that there is such a mitzvah as a revelation of Nevuah, that Mashiach will have Nevuah even before the Gola, and this is a me'ein, and this is a beginning of the real full gilui of Nevuah, which will be after the time of Gola. Now, we also have, the Rambam tells us, how do you know if a person is a legitimate Navi? So one way is if he does Oisus and Moifsim, maybe if he predicts things and they come absolutely true. But then you also have, the Rambam says, you don't necessarily need that. If you have Navi, if you have Ruvain the Navi testifies about Shimon the Navi, that Shimon is a legitimate Navi, then we automatically know that he's good. As the Rambam points out, for example, Yeshua didn't have to do any Oisus and Moifsim for the Jewish people to accept him. They accepted him because Moshe vouched for him. So therefore, the Rebbe goes on in the same way then, So, and in fact, as the Rambam goes on to say, you're also to second guess him and to think maybe his nevuah is not true and so forth. You have to believe that he's true and that Hashem is among them and not to question him. So, in other words, the implication is, in other words, that since we talked about in the piece yesterday, that the Baal Shem Tov and the Mezuzah Magid were of the caliber of Nevi'im, and each of them vouches for their Talmud after them, then it comes out that the whole dynasty of Rebbeim have a status of Nevi'im, as it ever develops the point in that sikha there. Continuing halachos of tzitzis. Now, so far we were talking about if you want to take the tzitzis strings off one beged and attach them to a different beged. What happens, for example, you might want to cut off the entire corner, tzitzis and all, and then sew it onto another beged. Can't do that. Even if it's not just the corner, what if you take a whole large piece of it and then sew it onto another garment that has only three corners? Can't do that. And if you do, then those tzitzis he brought over are possible, because then you have to, again, the problem of kasav lamina osri that we learned before. You have to have the kanaf is attached to the beged when you make the tzitzis on it, and here it's not because it wasn't attached, because here it was detached and then reattached with the tzitzis still on it. So when the corner is connected to the beged, then you put the tzitzis on it, and then it's good. But here, you brought over tzitzis from someplace else, so therefore it doesn't pass to it. You would have to untie those tzitzis, and then retie it after you sewed on that konaf. B'med v'ram amurim, the Alter Rebbe continues, when would that apply? If that piece that you brought over is not itself large enough to be a talus. Now, we're going to learn, in the next simon, we're going to learn what is the minimum size of a talus that is chayiv in tzitzis. So if that piece is not large enough for that, then it itself is not chayiv in tzitzis, and therefore, again, you can't sew it onto a new beged and have it work. But if that piece itself, with the tzitza attached, is big enough to be a talus that's chayiv in tzitzis on its own, then you do not need to take off the tzitzis imagine, in other words, you have one talus cut, and let's say where a whole corner of it ripped away and you have like a large part of it missing. So you might want to, you have, let's say, another talus cut, you're going to take a large enough piece from that other talus cut and attach it to this one. So here the Alter Rebbe is saying, as long as that new piece is itself large enough to be the minimum size for a talus cut, then you're fine and you could do that, because after all, it was connected to a beged that was chayiv in tzitzis, which had the shear of a talus to be chayiv in tzitzis, and now also it is, and therefore it's called the ikar beged. The Alter Rebbe does bring in kuntres achron that the Taz brings opinions that it's not so, but he brings from the Magen Avraham that doesn't worry about that. So the Alter Rebbe and the Pnim over here, when he's saying that it's allowed, is following the Magen Avraham in that. The Shara Perlo brings that the Alter Rebbe more often than not in the Shulchan Aruch relies on the Magen Avraham. Later on, it's brought that Tzemach Tzedek brings that the Alter Rebbe actually said that the Alter Rebbe actually said when he was older that he kind of regrets that he over relied on the Magen Avraham in that, and then felt that he should be more independent in his reasoning. La'alacha, but Lamaisa, the Shulchan Aruch, the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, as we have it in front of us, more often than not tends to follow the opinion of the Magen Avraham. Anyway, needless to say, the Alter Rebbe continues, if you don't plan to sew it onto another beged, let's say you want to take that piece itself and add more tzitzis to it, sure, you can do that. You don't have to take off the original tzitzis. It's still perfectly valid. You just add three more on the three corners, and you're good, and you have yourself a new talus cotton.
So you're going to have more than one tzitzis on the corner?
No. What we're talking about is, let's say, for example, so in the next simon, the Alter Rebbe is going to talk about the minimum size of a talus cotton. So let's say you have a huge talus. Let's say you have a huge talus where you want to take a piece from it, and so first the Alter Rebbe is talking about you want to take a piece from it and attach it to a different talus. So now we're saying if the piece that you're going to cut off of one and attach to the other is large enough to be a talus cut on its own, then you could do that without taking off the tzitzis. Now we're saying, in addition, and needless to say, another possibility would be to decide to take this piece that you took off, the large talus, and make it itself into a smaller talus cotton. That you could also do. You're going to go add three more tzitzis on the other three corners of it, and you're for sure good, because then, again, it has a sheer talus of its own, and therefore it's perfectly valid to have the original tzitzis on, and it's not considered passive lamin osri, and of course you can add other ones on the remaining, on the other. Because the point is, because it was large enough by itself to be a talus cotton. If you had it was only a corner or only a small piece which is not large enough to be a talus cotton, then you have this problem of tassav lemon also. It has to be al kanfedig dehim. It has to be the corner is part of the beged when the tzitzis are put on it. But if it itself is large enough to be a beged of its own, then you don't have that issue. So that's the point. Okay. Rav Chanan, I'm not sure I'm not sure if 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 I